Hi, I'm Bobby Favre.
And this is Babelito.
And we are Latinos Who Lunch, the podcast where we talk about important things like...
I detest cheap sentiment. What? Kasho, kasho, kasho. Babelito here, communicating words of wisdom from Chicagastlan. Hi, everybody. So, in this occasion, we are going to bring you a very special episode, a very special interview. Favi Fav is very busy right now, so he asked me to take over for this episode, and I recorded this interview in the summer. If you guys have been listening to the podcast for a while, especially since the beginning, because I don't know if you guys remember, but we had an episode where I talked about... my summer in Puebla. I mean, I guess we do that every year, but one specific episode where I picked up a 20 pesos bill, and then I started from un charco de agua in the street, and then I ate tacos, and then I got sick. It turns out that it wasn't that. It was some bad sushi that I had in downtown Puebla. But anyway, that's not the point of this. The point of this whole thing is that this is a special episode because this is an interview with the director of Arquetopia. And again, if you guys have been listening to us, and this is how this is related to that 20 pesos bill, is that the reason why I go to Puebla every year, it's to participate in summer programs with artists as part of Arquetopia, which is the largest residency of artists in Mexico. And Favi went over there. If you listen to our interviews with Lance Smith, he has also been there. And in total, I think I have sent 5 or 6 artists. And in this upcoming summer, 2 of my students are going to go to Arquetopia, which is really exciting. A lot of the things that I specifically talked about in the podcast, for example, last week or 2 weeks before, we talked about this idea of occupying space versus time. How, for example, in certain shows of TV shows, you just have our people in the background, just occupying space and not time. So this interview goes into all of those details, because a lot of the ideas that I bring in this podcast, the idea of anti-coloniality, which it was a conversation I had in Arquetopia with my friend Annette, ideas of space versus time, a lot of things that we bring into a conversation stem from my summers in Arquetopia. So I have been waiting for the right time to interview the director because I owe him a lot, not only in terms of my career, but also the ways that I process these ideas. This is a kind of interview that you need to listen to several times. We get into everything from the Middle Eastern influences of food in Puebla, all the way to like very complex ideas about that, space versus time. We get into the real meaning of microaggressions and many, many more things. So make sure to stick around all the way to the end because he's going to give us some of his essential books that he's used in the development of these ideas. Because everything that we talk about, racism, sexism, the way that Mexico functions in terms of race, the way that the empire functions, how do we participate in the empire. All of these ideas are part of larger ideas that he borrowed from list of books, you know, and a list of practices within Arquetopia. So he's going to tell us a little bit more about those books. And also make sure to stay till the end. I'll wrap up this episode and I'll give some shout outs from our Patreon and our PayPal patrons. Thank you, everybody. So without further ado, here it is, my interview with Paco from Arquetopia. Stick around to the end y seguimos conversando. Chao, chao, chao. Hola, Paco.
Hola, ¿qué tal? Thank you for this invitation. It's my honor.
Thank you so much. I've been nervous to ask you to be in the podcast, but this is the right time and I'm very excited. And there's so many things that I want to talk to you about. We are in an Airbnb in front of Arquetopia, and there's birds and there's things. It's Mexico. Deal with it, people. Anyway, so I want to talk about a lot of things, but first, what did we eat today?
Well, we had breakfast in our favorite place. It's the Bakery Cafe here in downtown Puebla, and they have wonderful huevos en cazuela. We got there too late, so we ended up not eating breakfast. So we had a sandwich with, it was chicken and basil and, of course, avocado. It was wonderful.
Okay, so fuck the sandwich. Tell everybody what huevos en cazuela. Huevos en cazuela are.
Well, that was my point. It's this one.
That's why you didn't describe the sandwich in detail.
Well, the sandwich was not really that good, but the huevos en cazuela, they're made in a cazuela from Puebla, because there's a specific neighborhood that makes them, El Barrio de la Luz, and it's a combination of Lebanese cuisine with Mexican cuisine, and it's the cazuela is brought to the table really hot with olive oil, and it's sunny side up eggs, onion. It's not jalapenos; it's the that skinny chili that is green, and also serrano. Oh, serrano. There you go, serrano, and then jocoque, which is this cheese that you say it's not cheese, but it's actually cheese. So it's wonderful, and then it has some spices, so it's really good.
The relationship between the Middle East and Puebla runs deep, because that was one of the most striking things, believe it or not. When the first time I came to Puebla, I'm like, tacos árabes? What the fuck is that?
Well, it's been a really interesting relationship to discover it. As you mentioned, it's been at least 9 years that you've been coming. I can't believe it's been that long. And this year we had a Palestinian scholar. His name is Karim Katan. And he was surprised to find all these connections between the Arab world and Puebla, and Mexico in general, but even our most important dishes are rooted in Arab cuisine. Mole poblano is not really, I mean, it's a combination. What I really like is how knowledge survives in that sense. That is a triumph, in terms, the empire takes over everything. But, it's my romantic way of relating to food. So yes.
Yeah, because you have mole, ajonjoli, I mean, the word itself. You have chiles en nogada, also from Puebla. Wasn't that a dessert?
It was a dessert. And also this combination of sweet and spicy and savory, that's also from the Arab world. So a lot of these ingredients are dry, like the chile en nogada has dried fruit and has seeds. Even mole has also dried fruit and seeds. So a lot of these layers of history, even Kristen Buick, that I'm sure you mentioned in your show, when she first came to Puebla, she mentioned how narrow the sidewalks were, because a lot of the important decisions in Mexico are taken inside the houses through family. And the structure of the houses are very similar to the Arab world. It has a patio with a fountain. It's very interesting.
This is fascinating, especially because we are obsessed in the U.S. right now, is trendy, what I call faux wokeness, this idea of decolonize everything. And there's like a movement of decolonizing food and this and that. And by doing that, we're denying a lot of pain that people went through, but also we're denying these processes that are part of who we are, like chiles en nogada, like the way that, like, even the streets are structured. So that's not to romanticize the empire, but to deny the colonial period is to deny all of these things that are part of who we are.
Yes, I think decolonization is impossible. I think it's actually a matter of understanding that resistance has always been happening with complexities. It's not, we can't also romanticize resistance in any way, but it's a process that has never stopped. So it's always important to contextualize and to understand how things function in context and how meaning is produced in context.
Did you hear that, everybody? That's why I keep coming back every year. So, but before we continue, because there's very specific things I want to talk to you about, tell me more about who you are. Tell me more about Archetopia, and then we can get into some deeper topics. I mean, we're already going deep. Ay, cálmense, cabrones, ya los conozco. But I want you to talk about Archetopia.
Yes, well, Archetopia started in 2009. I'm co-director of Archetopia. Chris Davis is also co-director of Archetopia. We founded it in 2009 in a long process of thinking about moving to Mexico, and then decided to stay in Mexico for several reasons. And then Nayeli Hernandez, who's programs coordinator, she also joined the project. And it started from the beginning, has been about education. And we had a street conservatory quote unquote, for, you know, inner city, downtown kids, you know, from different neighborhoods. The idea was to bring artists to work with students to find how to represent their own ideas and how to figure out their relationship with public space. Also, Chris is a classical clarinetist, so he has his studio that he still continues. So in this sense, this idea of bringing artists was what gave birth to the artists in residence programs. Currently, we have probably like 25 different residency programs within three spaces. We have the headquarters in Puebla, which is 2 hours from Mexico City. Then we have another residency space in Oaxaca, just 40 minutes outside of the city of Oaxaca. And then 2 years ago, we opened another residency program in Cusco in Peru, which has been really wonderful to establish this dialogue between processes in Peru and also Mexico, because I believe we can't understand the problems of Mexico without Peru and the opposite, you know. So it has been a really wonderful project and process. We've had probably 500 different artists from 85 different countries in the world, from all different regions, all different religions, all different diets, you know, in terms even of food. So it's been really wonderful in understanding how also residencies are so problematic. You know, we started this idea of thinking about exchange, and then we learn how it can be a fantasy co-optation instead of actual reciprocity. So we learned quickly that tourism and residencies are intertwined. Yes. So we've separated as much as possible. We've been putting the artistic practice in the center to build a critical dialogue around it, not putting the artist at the center, but the actual practice to understand how it functions. And from there, you know, many wonderful things have emerged. We've had really wonderful people, including you, of course, who had generously contributed to the vision. Kirsten Buick, of course, has been key in creating this very critical program that is also very rigorous in many ways. And, you know, every artist who comes to Arquetopia says it's a life-changing experience, which to me is really wonderful.
Ay, cabrón. Before we get into it, I really wanted to talk about the relationship that you personally, because you are from Puebla, you were born here, your family has been here for a long, long time. And I want to know how Puebla has shaped, especially after coming back from the United States, how that has shaped who you are, but also the relationship that Arquetopia has with the space.
That's a very, very interesting question, because Puebla doesn't have any merit in Mexican history other than the Battle of Cinco de Mayo. And that's because during the independence of Mexico and later on with Juarez, with President Juarez, our history was sort of decolonized. So we try to erase, and I say we loosely, I'm thinking in terms of national identity and nationhood in many ways. And Puebla was actually, well, first of all, Mexico was not a colony. It was not a colony of the Spanish Empire. It was an extension of the empire. And legally, that has different implications in terms of rights, you know, property, also how to engage in civil life. And that's why it's you know, class is so complicated in Mexico. So Puebla was erased from history because it was constructed as an imaginary city for purity in terms of European, which is also, I say it very loosely, who came from Europe into Mexico is highly complicated to address and to think about. But Puebla created this fiction of a city for Europeans. What is fascinating is that Puebla didn't produce much through the colonial period because it was the center of power. And anything that went into every direction of the world, because speaking of globalization, it's actually in the 16th century, that's when it actually happened. It had to go through Puebla, and it paid taxes in Puebla. So that's why you see the scale of architecture. That's why you see the collections that were created here. Most of the collections were private, eventually went into the federal government, and they're part of Munal, and they're part of...
By collections, you were talking about sculpture, painting?
Mostly painting, because that has been the most important representation and form of expression of the empire. And Puebla was a center for collecting. The first museum in the country was opened here, which is the Bello Museum, which was divided in two main collections. So it's a fascinating place because of the structure of the city. Puebla's cathedral is the only one whose coat of arms were not destroyed during the revolution or independence, so they still claim this connection with the Spanish Empire. Yes. So the King of Spain comes to Puebla and feels at home, you know, loosely saying it. But it's very interesting because my relationship with the city has been complicated from the beginning. It's, you know, it's very rigid and conservative, but also I didn't know how wonderful it could be. And growing up in this city, I thought food everywhere in the world would be like this. And boy, was I mistaken.
Wah, wah, wah.
Well, especially when I moved to Albuquerque, you know, the relationship that it has with Mexico is highly complicated. And coming from the center of the country is very different in terms of perception, identity, and all these processes of identification. So, but Puebla is wonderful. It's really a very interesting city that has 6 art schools. So there's a lot of things happening, not necessarily a gallery system, which also allows certain freedom. It has really wonderful archives that, you know, attest to the process of exchanges between different continents. So it's wonderful.
And that has helped shape the residencies. For example, mine, when I came to Puebla, I really just came to see you because I remember talking to you online. I tried to come the first year when Arquetopia was open. I couldn't do it. And then finally, I was able to come the second year. And I said, well, I'm going to spend a week, you know, like I have never been to Puebla. I'll go to Arquetopia. I'll hang out with Paco. And then I'll continue my journey. Because at that moment, I was looking for paintings to talk about in my dissertation. And it ended up in many, many ways, the center of my research. And it has a lot to do with understanding Puebla in a completely different way. So like the way that you explain Puebla was so important for the development of my dissertation. So I wonder how that impacts, I don't know, like a conceptual artist.
Well, it's first of all of our residency programs are rooted in the specific context of the residency or of the space in which they are located. So thinking about Mexico in general, in terms of national identity, we have these two opposites that create tension. And mostly when you think about national identity, as you've mentioned it before, this tension erases the complexity that actually is happening. And in terms of Mexico, this idea of European and this idea of indigenous, which is also highly complicated, you know, this, when we say indigenous, we say it loosely and we think it's a term that we could use for resistance, when in fact, Mexico has currently, I think, 63 different languages, complex languages with 11 distinct linguistic roots. None of them have a translation to the term indigenous.
Or India,
of course. Yeah. So these ideas that we created are from the empire. So when we think about Puebla, it places itself in the far end of the spectrum in terms of European. And then when we think about Oaxaca, it's the opposite. However, both of them create systems of discrimination in similar ways, just enacting different perspectives in terms of ideology. So what we do is we have these residency programs and they connect to the knowledge that created a lot of possibilities of change in terms of images, in terms of community and how they imagine themselves in that sense. So the space in Puebla has, you know, it is connected to the city. It's actually downtown Puebla. So we have printmaking and photography, ceramics, and mostly, you know, everything that is art production is created here. Also in terms of the archives that are available here. In Oaxaca, we have a program for fiber artists. So it's a lot of natural dyes and backstrap loom weaving, embroidery, tapestry, and also a program for writers. And then Cusco is a combination because in Puebla we have a residency that includes organic paint and colonial artistic techniques. So, for instance, pasta de caña, which is the husk of the, not the husk, the actual stem of the corn. And because it's so light, it was used to make this gigantic crucifixes. Yes. So all these techniques are similar in Cusco. In Cusco is called pasta de arroz. So we have also backstrap loom in terms of technology of color, the production of color through natural dyes is very different from Oaxaca. So it's a combination of both techniques. So an artist, when they come here, we use this possibility of the context as an excuse as a critical point of entry to their practice. So although they might be inspired by Mexico in many ways, we do not entertain this idea of the fantasy, not even of color or the picturesque or landscape or all these ideological distortions that come with art. And we begin to understand how the ways in which we see are connected to power and how that relationship also engages the viewer. So from there, many questions emerge, and there are many possibilities in terms of the technique, in terms of the production, etc.
So let's talk a little bit more about the relationship that art has with power, because we have this myth of the artist when it comes in the to artists in the United States and Europe. We have this idea that we're all almighty, right? The idea that we have a sensibility, which is an 18th century idea, to understand the world in different ways. And that can be traced back to the Greeks, because the Greeks believe that the poets could contextualize the world in a completely different way. Mm-hmm. So in a way, Greek gave its poets a position of power like no other. And fast forward to the Renaissance, the same idea. Pushing for the legitimacy of artists like Michelangelo and Da Vinci, they started to play this whole idea that they were geniuses. And that continues till today. When you go to grad school, in a way, you're fed into that whole entire system. So when they come from different places, they feel themselves in the centered. But the reality is that themselves and the production that they create, it's so much more complicated. So I wanted you to, in a way, help us deconstruct a little bit of that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, art is very powerful. It is very powerful. But this idea that art can change anything, it's absolutely absurd. Yes, because, well, it does. I'm saying this loosely, but one of the things that we need to understand is that empire is always implicated with art. So I always tell artists that art is always against us. Always. It doesn't matter what your intention is. It doesn't matter what technique or what school you went. Art is always against you and against everyone.
Okay, deconstruct that, because we, like in Latinos Who Lunch, we always talked about our roles as Latinx artists in the museum, but I don't think we've ever got into how we are also complicit into this empire games.
Well, one of the things that we need to remember is that art is always, it's one of the activities that we do that always includes an audience. It always is implicit and complicit. Right. So it cannot be separated in that sense. And I always question artists, who's your audience? Because, and they usually say through nationalism, they say, well, the audience is the viewer. Okay, the viewer has a body. How does that body look like? And that would explain what is your connection with power. Ooh. Who goes to your shows? Who sees your work? And then I ask them, who ideally would be your audience? Sometimes it's your mom, sometimes your dad, who has nothing to do with art, but they have the capacity to understand problems in a very complex way that connects from generation to generation. So we always have to question this idea of audience and who sees the work. And also, one of the things that I always tell the artists in residence is that art is always celebrating extermination, the extermination of people. Mm-hmm. Art is always celebrating the extinction of the environment. And art is always celebrating, of course, the appropriation of labor.
Okay, let's get into that, but one by one. What do you mean by the first one? Art is always at the service of extinction, you said.
Yes, I can explain each one of them. So, for instance, I got this from Nicholas Mirzov, which is a wonderful scholar. If you have a chance to read him, he has an essay that the title begins with "Empty the Museum: The Colonized Theory or Open Theory: The Colonized Space," I think, and he ends with a question saying, "I would like to imagine the possibility of an institution that doesn't celebrate these things and a few more," and from there I draw the conclusion that. For instance, when we say art celebrates the extinction of the environment, it has to do with the means of production. The garbage that we produce as artists. I mean, just think about the history of photography, the history of printmaking. Painting, of course, is highly toxic. I have several friends who cannot paint anymore because of lead in oil paint or any other technique. So it's highly polluting in many ways. And, you know, anything that we produce, it's already contaminating. Many ways. How it appropriates labor, it's fascinating, because art is one of those bodies that can actually accumulate wealth without doing anything. So when something is sitting on the museum and it's increasing its value to the millions of dollars, that means that money was taken from someone else. And that's through Walmart, and that's through OXXO, and that's through all these corporations. Yes, absolutely. So this idea that we can change things, maybe we think about it in a studio, but once you release it and it's in the market, it's impossible.
Right.
And then the third one, the extermination of people. That's because artists, we usually use bodies. We represent bodies, and we decide how those bodies needs to be used. And, you know, many artists through their production, and this is why I always say intention doesn't matter. Intention is always falling short. It's limited. And we have to think about, instead of intention, artistic agency, and how that, and artistic agency is easy to define, is how the work reacts in context, how the work, once you release it, once it's out of your studio, it behaves in context, because then as an artist, you're always a side note. You're not necessarily included, and the work will actually outlive you, which means you have to be careful what you put out, because it will be used against you in many ways. Many artists who define bodies through their work, and the work was used as a possibility of extermination to define who stays and who should be used and killed.
And I have an example. The abstract expressionist artists of the 1950s who, in the beginning, and this is something that David Craven talks about, the expressionist artists of the 1950s, if you're not familiar with them, it's, think about artists like Jackson Pollock, which I think it's very popular right now because it was a movie done like, I don't know, like a decade ago or so. But it is, they were making art with no non-figurative art, so muchas líneas and splashes and things like that. And at the beginning, they expressed this idea of anger against the United States in a way, continuing the colonization of the world through wars. Fast forward 5-10 years of the beginning of abstract expressionist artists in New York in the 1950s, the CIA organizes an exhibition to travel around the world, and they use abstract expressionist artists as an example of how the cultural center of the world has shifted from Paris to New York. So David Craven talks about how those intentions are taken back now in the 1980s to Central America. But we don't know what's going to happen to that body of work later on and how the empire is going to use it. So if you have somebody listening at home or driving or walking and they're like, fuck, or they say, you know what? No, I'm not part of that equation because my intention is this, because my art doesn't look nothing like I think the empire looks like. How is it that every single piece of art or every artist are celebrating extinction? And again, we use the word extinction because as I forgot the name of the scholar. There's a scholar who talks about it, when we use the word genocide, it's too much related in the United States to the idea of the Holocaust. Yes. But this is much complicated.
Yes. Well, it's extermination, the term that we always use, because it has to do with, and Kristen Buick in her seminar this summer explained it as a way of pushing these communities to the margin. So it becomes, while genocide is a legal term that is used in a specific context, extermination can be used for the empire continuously to recreate the border, recreate the idea of the center and the margin, and of course create all these technologies to eliminate people. Yes. What were you asking me?
So I'm listening at home and I make art. It's something very personal to me. How am I, let's say I make abstract art, let's say the intentions of my art, or I don't know, the profits of my art are going to go help kids in the border. How am I contributing to this narrative that you're talking about?
Well, it has to do with agency, because once the curator of a museum decides the narrative, and we have to remember that museums are temples of genocide, of extermination, just like churches are. Not necessarily that I'm against any church or any religion in per se, but it is how it has been constructed and it is how it functions. The problem here is, and we always use the example of the snake charmer. You remember that painting from the 19th century in which we see these people sitting and they're there's this boy or girl with a snake, and then the snake charmer is next to him or her, and it's highly problematic because this character is naked. If you have a chance to Google that painting, the snake charmer, and it's Jerome. I don't remember his first name, and
it's a 19th century painting. It's part of the Orientalist movement, where like France is starting to idealize Morocco and all of this
places that are not part of France, imaginary in a highly exotic way. And the painting looks pristine, the linear quality, almost like photography.
Right. And that painting, as you mentioned, is highly problematic because it allowed the possibility of the French Empire to expand and to exterminate many people. Do we think that the artist had that intention? It doesn't really matter. Now, when we go to the museum and we see this probably underage character in front of men, we sense it's problematic. But because we have to perform with the museum in terms of authority, and we paid already our entrance to the museum, then we just agree with it. So how we engage in these ways of seeing, and what is the aftermath of what happens with the work, we cannot control it as artists. So I always ask artists to think about how the work performs meaning in context, because meaning is never intrinsic. It's never fixed into any object. And actually, I don't even consider objects as a subject-object relationship that I think and then the object doesn't think. It's actually we appear in space and other bodies appear in space. Some are animated, some are inanimated, but we create that meaning in context. So we cannot control how the work is going to behave in the future. And that means our intention is not automatically embedded in the work because there's no essence. So how it's being used against, for instance, specific communities to be represented, and even when we think about borders, how the ideas of specific communities to be targeted, and it's something that we are familiar with. We used to think we were already over that. We used to think that we had already, change. And then we see the border again in the U.S. and Mexico and how it's creating all these extermination process. And it's always for wealth.
They woke people. And that's the idea that, like, that happened in the United States. We had this post relationship with everything, post this, post that, post racial. But the reality is that we are understanding, for the first time, a lot of people are finally understanding that that's not the case at all. And then these processes are, if anything, are intensifying. So it's so interesting because I think if grad school will open up with these three possibilities, the relationship and the artwork that will be created within those spaces will be completely, completely different.
Well, one of the things that I always suggest, because we are trained through the academies, art school precisely, to think about statements. And that's because the academies and the empire wants to predict what are you going to produce and how it's going to be sold. You know, it's all about money. So I always shift the conversation to think about questions, because our experience is valid. It doesn't mean we can't be speaking for a whole community, but that means that our experience is valid and that we have knowledge. So if you turn your statement into an open-ended question, then that allows the possibility of the work to behave in different ways once you release it. And when that happens, a curator will not know how to deal with the work, which is the point.
And in a way, those are decisions that you have to make, because, I mean, some people have to make the decision of going one way or another, depending on, are you making a career just on art? How do you manage this, the art markets, the museum world? And it's very complicated. And as POC people, it's even much more complicated.
Right. And we talked about this several times, you know, when we think about Mexico as an imperial fantasy, as a landscape, as, you know, you can Google so many terms connected to Mexico. And it's even the official way of advertising Mexico in terms of tourism. Mexico and colors are intertwined, just like Peru and landscape or Peru and gold are intertwined. And they become these jewel that you want to achieve through Instagram, to photograph, to, you know, this tropical paradise where everything can be done.
Right. So with that said, what are some of the challenges that you have had with residents that might have had those expectations? And I always use the case of Frida, because everybody know in the podcast now that I'm the anti-Frida. But I have one of the main ideas behind that, and one of the reasons behind the way that I'm so critical about the image of Frida is because what I have seen here in Arquetopia. So can you talk a little bit more about, not necessarily just Frida, but like the sort of expectations of the fantasy of Mexico, Peru, and other places that the challenges that you have to go through?
Well, absolutely. First of all, Frida is highly problematic for many reasons, I'm sure that you've mentioned. But especially because she piloted all these possibilities of knowledge and change and technology and communication to render as one layer. So essentially, she's a character that recreates this fantasy of the Universal Exposition in how she behaves, in how she portrays gender, in how she's connected to nature, in how everything is about feeling as opposed to thinking. And you can tell that she knew the rules of art history.
Right.
And she was key in making Diego Rivera's career successful. She was in charge of her all her mail and all you know, she was the bookkeeper. I mean, she kept record. Yes, his mail, yes. So she was key in making him successful. He knew that when he walked down the street in New York with this piñata next to her, right next to him, sorry, he could sell more work. So it's this idea of the authentic at the inauthentic, you know, that is so highly problematic. And I think the biggest challenge in terms of Arquetopia and residencies in general, especially in communities that have been distorted ideologically with these ways of representation, is the idea of past as a place.
Okay, explain that, because that's something that it's so important for some of our audience to like to start talking, because I really want these ideas to really start as dialogue.
Right. Well, a lot of these representations, for instance, an example of past as a place could be landscape, which is intertwined with the idea of Peru. The first thing that you imagine about Peru is Machu Picchu, and not the technology behind Machu Picchu, but the mountains. So this idea of how you can fix someone in the past to become a place. And remember that, you know, all of these conversations are highly complicated because we center everything that we do in the encounter, which has to do with Immanuel Levinas, which is a philosopher, and we can talk about it later. But it's this idea that when you encounter someone, you cannot have all these ideological distortions, all these preconceived ideas of who you are actually encountering. And that applies to anyone, you know, even how your mom is to you or me or anyone today is not the same mom that you had 15 years ago. So people change, and people are not just people with a fixed meaning. So how we allow that possibility to change has to do with the encounter. And the encounter is contingent to two conditions. One is time, and the other one is space. And space is a relationship that we establish with one another. You know, you are a certain number of centimeters away from me, or, you know, or many miles. So that's space. That's the space that we create. There's a difference between place and space. Place is actually the same idea of space, but it's actually mapped and controlled because it's been represented. And I'm sure you talked about this, you know, through maps, through landscape, through photography. And the problem with with place is that it becomes property. So when you think about place and maps make sense because it was a way to control, for instance, the Americas. So when the encounter happens, people imagine through tourism, and that also emerged, I think, in the 18th century and then the 19th century as classes start getting wealthier. And this distortion in space becomes place. And if you think about it, it's a whole technology that has been created. You know, museums are actually constructed that way. It makes you feel that you can control time as you move through the museum, while the museum is stuck, is passed as a place. So when you see, quote unquote, indigenous in the landscape, they're actually fixed in past as a place.
And that's, in a way, kind of the problem of like this sort of fucked up tourism promoted by ideas of Frida Kahlo, that in people's minds, Mexico is set in the past, and you arrive wanted to enact that fantasy.
Well, yes, and remember that desire and art are always intertwined, and also sexual desire. So all these problems, you know, when we think about Frida, for instance, and we think that she was a feminist and she was liberated, that group of artists were absolutely homophobic. They allow their freedom because we always experience, everyone experiences freedom at the expense of very specific targeted groups. So, for instance, they ostracize other possibilities of imagining gender in the 40s and the 50s and then later on. So it is highly problematic because as we think about Mexico, as we think about Latin America, and even other residences, because now that we have established agreements with other spaces in other places or, you know, in other countries around the world, they find similar challenges. How, you know, specific ways of seeing makes you imagine that you can control time. And even when, you know, even when you see advertisements about bus and traveling and even plane, it's the idea that you control time and progress and technology moving through it while everything is fixed in this idea of place.
And this idea of having all these elements fixed, technology, fantasy, color, all of that authenticates our experience with the others, right? And that's the problem with the idea of authenticity, that at the end of the day, from eating that authentic taco in the restaurant to visiting Peru and spending thousands of dollars, the only thing that that whole idea is doing is authenticating yourself and your experience.
Well, it's actually, you know, when you say technology, it's usually framed as tradition. So it is traditional this traditional that, when in fact tradition is never tradition. It's a burden that we have to carry. I always shift the conversation to understand it as knowledge, as technology. Even when we talk about the natural dyes residency, I always say the technology of producing color. There's this idea of what is natural is even problematic. So it has to be shifted, because when we establish this relationship with another person, because I don't even use the word other as right. This idea that it has been constructed through continental philosophy of who's opposite, who to the one who thinks, yeah. Right? So it is highly problematic in many ways, because it creates these notions, again, of who controls times and who is fixed in space. And that's through the idea of what is authentic. So when we seek something authentic, that means that we are unauthentic. Because that allows modernity to take over, because it's all about time, it's all about progress, it's all about moving forward. You decide to be inauthentic, unauthentic, I think it's the term, so that the other one can be authentic, because then it can be fixed in time, so that you can control space. And when you think about any discourse, any speech in terms of government, you'll see how the U.S. will, for instance, will speak about technology and progress and moving forward. And when it's about Latin America, it's all about landscape and color and nature and tradition. Yes.
Because he has fixed them in the past. And that fixation, in a way, allows us to create this relationship between the authentic and us, the inauthentic. So the inauthentic is a person that can fix things in the past.
Exactly. And, you know, Sharon Holland, she's a wonderful scholar. I love her and I admire her so much. She's actually on a board of directors, and she wrote this book, The Erotic Life of Racism. If you have a chance to get it, anyone who's listening, it's a wonderful, wonderful book, because she explains the problem of the encounter and also how time and space have to be corrected in the encounter, and how place, you know, past can be a place.
And her chapter is so awesome, because she talks about listening to Tupac on the in a parking lot, and like this white lady coming to her, and then how everything that we're talking about here in the podcast and in this episode was enacted in that moment. So by me, when I read that, for example, I realized that this shit can happen every day at all times.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I remember, and I had this awful, awful, awful experience with German curator. Not that I am against Germans at all. You know, it was just one specific experience. But I remember I was in Canada in a meeting about the arts, and she approached me because she wanted to bring an exhibition to Mexico that we actually brought. And the first thing she said when she opened her mouth, "Wow, your English is wonderful." And of course, when you have been raised with this idea of class and manners, you say thank you, blah, 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 and you explain why. And I didn't realize that was her way of fixing me in the past. Right, because I was not, you know, I was not trained that way, and I didn't know that. So now when anyone approaches me and in this international, you know, because we have to go to international conferences with the residency program sometimes, and I had experiences with, you know, an Austrian man would approach me and say, wow, your English is wonderful. And I always say, well, yours is not that good, but I can understand you.
And you know, that's something that I think we all of us can relate, because we've all had those experiences. I remember that when I was working back in the day at Caesar's Palace, this lady came in. She's like, you're from Mexico. I love Mark Anthony. And I was like, what the fuck? But it's important to understand these ideas in more critical and complex ways, because we always, in a way, we always treat them as microaggressions. And we talk about microaggressions a lot. But in a way, that's not allowing for more room for how can we see that moment that you're going through, how can we put it in place in a more historical and important and critical way?
Right. And to me, the most important aspect is to correct the problem of the space and time dimension in the encounter. When this person approaches me, he wants to fix me in the past, and I counter-react to that to remind him we are in the same time and space dimension. That's what key. And Kristen says it in a really interesting way. She says, when the garbage is too much, you just have to give it back. At least half of it, so that they can burden that load.
Oh, wow. Okay, so explain that one more time, because this is key.
Well, what I in the encounter, you cannot be predisposed. We all are, because of the way in which we were raised, the school, the country, whatever. But we have to be open to see beyond the body, beyond what we are thinking, what we see. So when a person approaches you and say, wow, your English is so good, it means that because you are the cannibal historically, or I don't know what fantasy is creating in his mind, but he's fixing me in the past. So for instance, I had an experience, and usually when I travel, I was in Portugal, and as soon as I arrived, the guy questioned me in custom, in immigration, and he said, is this your first time in Europe? And I said, sadly, no, and it won't be the last one, sadly, as well. He was like, okay, move. And that's correct in the encounter, because he thinks that I am a menace, that I am dangerous, that I am, because I represent, yes, that anxiety that, you know, it historically has been constructed, and you shouldn't be able, it's trying to use your privilege against you to say, you know, I notice that you're here, but you actually shouldn't be here. I notice that you have good English, but you shouldn't be speaking like this, because it's this imagination and anxiety that it creates. So when we counter-react to that, it's correcting the idea, you know, the perception of space and time, to remind them that we are in the same space, you know, we're creating space together, and also time.
Damn, pues ahí lo tienen. Like, this is amazing, because these are ideas that in the surface may seem very abstract, but the reality of things is that, yes, sometimes certain academic journals or books can be very complicated, but also allow us to articulate these ideas to the point that you come back to that everyday experience. How have you been using some of those? This you mentioned a lot, using this critical text, which in a way, some people think that these are a way to push, right, like to create difference.
Right. Yes. Well, one of the things that I hate this name dropping, and I know this, and I know that I hate that. It's not about that. You know, to me, academic theory, language theory, writing has to be useful, and I always explain, because we get artists from many parts of the world. Many, you know, usually artists from the U.S. have been exposed to these critical writings more than any other artists, but you know, it varies. So I always explain that it's like jumping on a fast speed train. And as you're holding yourself to the train, because, you know, it's you're almost falling off the train because it's going to you know, high speed, you're able to get into the car, you know, and you finally see that there's a bunch of white, fat, ugly men, probably straight, yelling at each other. And once you find your seat and you're actually getting comfortable, you realize that you're yelling about you. And they're actually saying, determining what you're going to do next. And as much as you want to participate, they won't allow you. So that's really what academic language is about, is preventing you to participate. And the thing is, it's always defining who we are, just like museums. If we don't go to museums, we won't participate. And museums speak about us. They say what we have to do. So I always make them see how important, because many of the artists say this is very difficult. It is. It's made difficult so that you will not participate. We will not participate. So I always ground theory, because my point in this process of time and space and understanding is that your work has to produce that. When you ask me, how can we change that? If your work is able to create a space in between the viewer, whoever that is, and the work, and recreate the process of the encounter without these ideological distortions, mm-hmm. class, race, gender, age, etc.
Hate.
Right. It's precisely hate. Then it would actually change something. It would actually challenge the empire.
Well, as you guys know, we are completely independent-run podcasts, and we love our listeners, and we couldn't do it without your support. However, now we have some new ways to support this show. For those with commitment issues, the first option is to donate directly to our PayPal. It can be a donation of any size, and as many times as you like. In return, we'll give you a shout-out on an upcoming episode. Our PayPal link is on the latinoswholunch.com donate page. Again, it's on our latinoswholunch.com donate page.
And for all of you committed folks out there, if you want to support us on Patreon, you can do that too. For only $3, you can join our shout out level and get a shout out for every month you subscribe.
But if you want to be more of a badass, no, everybody, you can become our comadre. You can get a shout out and an additional exclusive episode every month for a $10 donation.
But wait, there's more. Become a Latinos Who Lunch madrina at $15 a month and get everything from our first two levels. And we'll also send you an LWL sticker. Or actually, LWL stickers, plural, okay? We ain't cheap around here. We'll send you a couple.
Several of them.
And we'll give you early access to our episodes. And we have a few special episodes already planned. So we're very excited. Again, you can donate on PayPal or on Patreon. Go to latinoswholunch.com, donate.
Si se puede. Si se puede. That was one last thing that I wanted to mention that I forgot. You mentioned for a second this idea of visibility. We have had a whole complicated relationship about visibility here in the podcast because we are bred to understand or to think that the more visibility there is for us out there, the more we are, we're participating in these processes. And yes, representation matters, as we always say in the podcast, but it doesn't mean that that's the end. And it was till I understood that visibility was a trap, that it's not necessarily the end of this fight of resistance that you're mentioning. So can you tell us a little bit more about how you approach this idea of visibility with your residents?
Well, yes, because, you know, Adorno says that the capacity of representation is the measure of domination. So the more we are represented, the more we'll be dominated. Yes. So, you know, one of the things that I was discussing with Kirsten Buick this summer is that because a lot of all this ideology creates distortion, how we perceive class, how we perceive race, because race is actually the product of racism. So when you say racism, people get quiet and they get uncomfortable. When you say race, they're willing to participate in the conversation. So we normalize these ways of, you know, these possibilities of violence. And same with class, same with gender, and same with nation and nationalism. So these ideologies create distortions in the perception of time and space, or both. And how you can correct that is through distortion. Because if you use the body to represent anything, then that will be dominated. That's the problem with representation. So it's never enough just to be, when I hear Sam Hayek saying that she represents Latinos or Latinx, or, you know, it's bullshit, you know. Right. And the question is, because a lot of these conversations end up trying to figure out what to do with your privilege. And as Kirsten Buick always says, it's not about white guilt, it's about white absolution.
Explain that, because this is so interesting.
Well, yes, because white guilt is a way of washing it off. When in fact you want when you want to be absolved of your privilege so that you can continue to do the work of the empire. And whiteness, I always say this to artists, whiteness is not in the skin, it's in the head. It's inside the head. It's our relationship with power. Can we find white Mexicans? Of course. Can I perform white Mexican? Probably. Have I been perceived as a white Mexican maybe at UNM? Probably. Mm-hmm. Yes, and even by professors. So, you know, it is interesting because it is a relationship with power, and we have to figure out what, because the question is not how to get rid of privilege. Everyone has privilege in a degree or another degree, and it's always in relation to other people that we measure that. And the question here is what you do with your privilege, not really how you get rid of it, because you can't.
So how would you say to those who they might say, well, this idea of whiteness is not on the skin, it's easy to say because I, with dark skin, I have experienced the opposite of what you just said.
Right. Well, it's what Audre Lorde says. Non-dominant differences. And I always show this example. No one can be closer to you biologically, genetically, even naturally, if we believe in that, as your mother or your father. But no one can be more different from you than your mother or your father, because at your age, they had completely different experiences. So that means that anyone beyond your father and your mother, they're actually very or absolutely different from you. And she refers to that as non-dominant differences. And she says we need to embrace them. And she even begins her text, the Master Tools Will Never Dismantle the Master's House, by interrupting. She puts, and if you have a chance to read that, it's a short essay. It's actually the speech that she gave in this conference. And she puts every feminist in their place by saying what you refer to in terms of class and race and gender and money, and it's just bullshit. It's your own hate projected to use patriarchy against yourself and then dominate whatever you want to change. When in fact, she says, we need to embrace differences, and that means this idea that I don't see race that Meryl Streep talks about is just stupid.
Right.
Yes. So it's about embracing differences, but differences in the sense that we can never understand each other. We barely understand ourselves. So we always say that two realities we have to face. The first one is that we are always alone, because even if we're talking right now, the more I talk and the more I explain, the more you understand about yourself and the less you understand about me.
Right.
And the other way around, right?
Yeah.
So that gives us one certainty, that we are always alone. And the second one that gives us a lot of anxiety is that we're actually dying. Every second as we live, we die.
Right.
So then that makes us understand that there's only space and time as a dimension. And the encounter is essential because how we perceive reality is only a perception. And we have to make sense of that perception, knowing that we cannot comprehend anything beyond ourselves. So we have to be open to differences all the time. And if we're able to make our practice about that, you know, I always talk about performativity. I always talk about the face-to-face encounter through Levinas. And, you know, the scholar who's wonderful in terms of performativity is Amelia Jones. She has this wonderful book, Performing the Body, Performing the Text, that I highly recommend, because it helps us to understand that even color, when we think about color, and I always get artists who start, well, green makes you this and orange makes you hungry. That's just bullshit. You know, the history of color is fascinating and it's connected to slavery in vicious ways and power. And in reality, color is an event. It's something that happens that cannot be measured, that cannot be, because even if we think we have nailed red and we understand how red functions, scientists have not been able to explain if the red that you perceive is the same red that I perceive. So everything is an event, and it happens as events, as appearances. You know, also Hannah Arendt talks about the space of appearance and how it is connected to power. So there's many possibilities in the practice if we think about performativity, because that's what makes it radical.
And I want to come back really fast. I keep saying one last thing of this idea of understanding our differences, because that's when I say empathy is dangerous. People are like, what? I've always thought that empathy is important for helping each other, surviving the world, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is that empathy is the failure of understanding those differences.
Well, it is impossible to understand differences. What we have to do is respect the integrity of differences. Because when we say understanding, it's the work of empathy. So what we have to do, and Levinas talks about the encounter, the face-to-face encounter, and he says that empathy is a pre-ethical state, meaning that it prevents you from being ethical, because in the encounter, we understand that something greater is actually appearing in front of us. So that's what makes, when we embrace that and when we commit to that, and even, you know, Levinas was regarded as too radical for phenomenologists, because he extended the encounter to a third person that is actually not in the encounter, because he says that the face is so powerful that it commands and forces you to commit. And my approach to the practice is that the artwork has to allow a face-to-face encounter. And if we make that radical, it's basically what you have mentioned before. It's not about feeling. It's a complex system that happens when we encounter each other. But it's not how the work makes you feel, because it's just that bullshit. Right, right.
So yeah, and this is important, because that's how we fall into the traps. And I have mentioned before in the podcast how enraged I was with those pictures of those kids in those cages in the border. We all engage with those pictures, and at the end of the day, that's what we did. Our relationship with those pictures ended up amplifying empathy. But as you say, it's pre-ethical. We didn't do shit about it. Some people be like, oh, I donated, or I went, or I did that. But the reality is, the problem continues. So I think that those sort of images, while yeah, they're conveying information of the violences that are happening in the border, don't necessarily absolve us of our complacency with what's happening, but also the problem that is happening.
Right. And I always, and I've also had this conversation with Kristen before, hope is a form of empathy, because it makes you believe that you're doing while you're sitting doing nothing. It's all about action. It's all about, and action not in terms of activism. It's in terms of how we understand differences and commit to ethics. We have to understand how things function, what is the final outcome of things. And I was thinking, when he was describing about these camps, I was thinking about Olympia and Manet, and how all this conversation about how he empowered women and how we empower the body, and he talked about class, when in fact that work is about prostitution. And when you think about prostitution, it is closest in nature of the capitalist relationship. That's what we need to look for. What is the actual relationship to capitalism? And then it won't be about feelings, because it will be about feelings to make you angry.
Right.
But whenever I have thought of a project in terms of feelings, oh, this is a wonderful project, it ends up being bullshit. So feelings clouds this possibility of understanding the complexity. So whenever I see that, it's always a red flag.
Yeah, and for the Manet is a 19th century artist that has been championed because he was going against a lot of the ideas of the academy. But the problem with the way that we talked about art is always in color and line and all this, what we call in art history, formal elements, as opposed to the most critical ideas about ideology, about history, about colonizations, and about empire. So there's a lot to think about. So I know I'm going to listen to this interview several times, because I think that a lot of these things are not necessarily just useful for artists in their practice, but I feel like when you start when you start thinking about a lot of these ideas in our everyday relationships from people to objects to the world, I feel like, I don't know, I'm not going to be hopeful, but I feel like we can begin to see a change. Yeah, I guess that's hopeful, but oh well.
Well, no, I mean, change is painful. Audre Lorde says also that change is very painful, because in the encounter, it requires friction. And I always refer to the friction as the sparks, because the empire is invested in minimizing friction, because and that's how gender is used, race is used, class is used. You have to predict how the person is going to behave in the encounter, because the machine has to be smooth. So what we have to do to embrace is the friction, because the friction produces sparks, and those sparks are knowledge. And that's what Audre Lorde says, descending to the chaos of knowledge to emerge with a possibility of a vision of true change in the future.
And knowledge and staying woke fucking hurts, so deal with it. So with that said, let's end this interview with recommendations. I am going to leave those to you because you've mentioned a couple of books throughout our conversation. So why don't you tell our audience three books, and I will go ahead and put those links in the website so you can access them. Sometimes, and we can be smart about this, but sometimes those books can be found free on PDF. And I think one of the books that I recommended a long time ago was Silence in History, and I put a link to the actual PDF online. So why don't you tell us three books and maybe ways to find it?
Yes. Well, I would highly recommend Performing the Body, Performing the Text by Emilia Jones, and it's she co-edited it with another scholar. You can probably find it in Amazon. Some universities also have it in their libraries, and you might be able to find some essays online. Sharon Holland's book, The Erotic Life of Racism, is wonderful. Wonderful, wonderful. I highly recommend her. I have... I have it in Kindle. I have it in printed. I always have it near me. There's also a book that you can actually find online. It's Contemporary Artist Residencies: Reclaiming Time and Space, and I wrote an essay there, precisely addressing the problem of residencies in terms of creating this idea of past as place. So I'd recommend that. There's also many other scholars, and it's edited by Taru Elfing, Irmeli Coco, and Pascal Gilliel. So it's, let me see if I can find the actual bookhouse, Valleys in Amsterdam, and I'll give you the link so that people can actually download it and use it.
Excellent. So just tell us how people can apply to Archetopia, where can they find you on the web, and yeah.
Absolutely. Well, we have a website, archetopia.org. We also have social media, so Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, etc. You can also find a few interviews where I talk about Mexico and how time is not money in Mexico. I think you can find it in Hyperallergic. And we have several open calls through the year. Usually it's like 7 different open calls, depending on, as they apply, artists apply to different programs, we get filled up because usually the programs are one-on-one. So we have always a mix of artists. But there's always an open call published on our website and also other websites as well.
So pay attention. All of those links will be on the actual Latinos Who Lunch website. So make sure to go and find a little bit more about Archetopia, if that program is for you. And if you decide to go, if you have the means, if you have the privilege to cross the border, I highly, highly, highly recommend it. Paco, it's been a pleasure. This is an interview that I wanted to do so long ago, but things happen for a reason and time works in mysterious ways. So I'm so glad that we finally were able to do this.
Absolutely. And, I can't believe it's been already 9 years since you've been coming. You've been key also to create this wonderful program. A lot of the content emerged from one workshop that you gave the first year that you came. So I want to publicly thank you for that. You're also one of our dearest board members and of course, a very dear friend. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
The same. I have not been the same ever since I started coming to Archetopia. Y reniego cada año because I'm like, oh, I have to travel 10 days without my boo, this, and that. But it's always been so fruitful. And everything that I learned through the summer, through your artists, through the board members, through just our conversations, gives me strength and gives me food for the rest of the year. So as I am wrapping up my week here, I cannot wait for next year.
Al contrario, muchas, muchas gracias.
Pues nos vemos. Uff, pues ahí lo tienen. This is, as I said in the interview and as I said before, and I'm gonna say it again, this is an interview that I have listened to many, many times. I'm actually giving it to my students because a lot of the things that we talk about relate to my class on landscape. So I'm very happy I get to actually record this and keep it in a file, like keep it in something that I can go back to because it's, I don't know, like those are things that I've been listening to and hearing about for, I don't know, 10 years or so. And some of them just starting to make sense. And this has a lot to do with the state of the world today, the way that
things are developing in the White House, the way that social media has had such a huge impact in the everyday relationships, or as what Paco calls it, the everyday encounter. So thinking about these interactions in relationship to the encounter has helped me tremendously, not only to make sense of artwork that I study, of artwork that I teach, but also my own personal relationship. So thank you again to Paco and to everybody in Archetopia. If you want more information about Archetopia, as I mentioned before, it's going to be in the actual website. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And if you have any questions, you always know where to find us. So again, as always, follow us at latinoswholunch.com on all social media platforms. You can also visit us at latinoswholunch.com. Send us letters, emails, voice messages to asklwlpod@gmail.com. Otra vez, para que no se les olvide, asklwlpod@gmail.com. Please leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. 5 stars solamente, because the more reviews we have, the more visible we are. And visibility leads to representation, and representation, as we always say, matters. Support us by making a donation to our PayPal, and we'll give you a shout out, or you can subscribe to one of our 3 Patreon levels, which all come with the perks. Both can be found on the latinoswholunch.com donate page. In this time, we want to give a huge shout out to several of our Patreon patrons. First, thank you so much to Vanessa for your donation. The same to Indira. Thank you, Vanessa. Thank you, Indira. We really, really appreciate it. And Vanessa left us a very nice message. She says, thank you for enriching my knowledge of Mexicanidad, and the banter is just a bonus. You're welcome, girl. We also want to give a big shout out to our PayPal patrons, Stephanie, Chris, Veronica, Osiris. Hey, girl. Thank you so much. A big shout out to all of you. And Stephanie also left us a very nice message. She said, so glad to have LWL back in my life. Welcome back, you all. Again, thank you very much to everybody. And also, Veronica left us a nice message. Love your show. I've been interested in the arts since I was a teenager. I enjoy going to art shows and supporting artists. I remember buying my first painting from an artist when I was 15 years old, even though I had a little bit of money from a part-time job. Additionally, I work in higher education, so your show is the perfect podcast for me. I love hearing about different artists, educators, creators, and researchers. Thank you for all the time and effort you put into your show. It gives me so much life. So guess what, Mimi? It gives us so much life that you are able to donate and continue to support us. Again, thank you. Thank you very much to everybody in Patreon. Shout out to all of you, and also on PayPal. The episode was edited and produced by Justin Favela and Emmanuel Ortega. The music is from the band Brown Out. I'm Babelito. Ciao, ciao, ciao.